and welcome to, I want to say episode 2 for 2022 of FP90. We've got Mikey back, and thankfully he's given me the opportunity to try my hand at hosting, which is something we never thought would happen, but here we are.
Don't get too comfortable now, you know.
Yeah, it's gonna get to his head.
And I hope I don't disappoint. But yeah, we've got a pretty much a similar episode to the one Aaron and I gave you guys a couple of days ago. We're going to be looking at the Champions League matches from this week in both halves. So first half, we're going to be speaking about the Tuesday night matches, Chelsea versus Lille and VRL versus Juventus. And then we'll get on to Benfica, Ajax and Atleti, Man United in the next segment. All right, so I think I'm just going to go straight to it. It's good to have you back, Mikey. We really enjoyed our episode without you, but hopefully you'll come back strong. All right, can you take us through the Chelsea game? Very briefly.
Yeah, I think the Chelsea game was pretty interesting. We played for sure pretty well, and I think there's some themes there that maybe... you know, fit into some of the narratives been going around recently with, like, Lukaku and stuff like that. And, you know, because we played pretty well without him in the side and with Kai actually as striker. Overall, I wouldn't say it was, like, this overly dominant performance in the sense where, like, in all aspects of the game. But I think there were a few key areas where we really kind of took it to Lille and exposed them. Like, I think Lille at times were... Well, early on the game, we got a very good start. And it was, I think, really playing, exploiting that right-hand side where we had Aspi and Ziyech doubling up on their left back because they left particularly a large gap between their midfield and defensive lines. And I think that then allowed Christian Pulisic to tuck inside a little bit and use that space in that gap to really drive with the ball. And that's why you saw, like, high-level performances pretty much and high ratings from all of those guys.
I actually want to touch on a couple of those things. You've actually touched on three sore notes that I actually had there. Firstly, I just want to say that, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Lille this season. Govanak, I think, is a bad manager. But yeah, just...
Yeah, you know better than I do, for sure.
What struck me instantly was just how awful they were defensively. I mean, they put out, like, a block, but it was this, you know, like, pretty porous block. And there's one of the key things of any basic block is you either want to be pressing the team to either flank or not allowing them through the middle, which Lille were doing nothing. Their players were pretty static. The only guy who I think really came out with any credits, at least in possession, was Renato Sanchez.
So what they had a problem with when trying to cover and when Aspi was pushing up. Like, Aspi is not traditionally, you know, a guy who is the most attacking wing back, but sometimes when that space is afforded to him, he's quite good to be able to create those kind of combo plays to help move the ball and progress it forward. And that's why when the ball was kind of switched quite often over the top from Rudiger's side all the way to Aspi doubling up with him and Ziyech, and the left-sided pivot player and both the wide midfielder, like, at times they were going to have to come help, you know, support that fullback because there was always a consistent 2v1 that was created. And in terms of how quickly we were able to get that ball out and move it across, they weren't able to, like you were talking about, there was issues in their block where they really weren't able to kind of compensate for that as well. Outside of, like, I think that's where most of our attacking threat came in, from that right side, and then Pulisic also taking advantage of them trying to recover and taking in that space in the central area to be able to drive, as well as you saw Conte for the second goal in transition. Overly ambitious press by Lille. Lost about Conte just driving completely at the back line and stuff.
I thought
Conte
was really, really good.
He was really good. And you know what, as well?
Only turn up in Europe nowadays. I mean, with all
no,
the...
No, okay, hold on.
I don't know. I don't know about that one.
he's still sick, but I think, like, he's just, like, we need to wrap him in bubble wrap because this guy, like, he's getting older, but he's such an asset when he's at his best. Like, he just is, like, been one of the best midfielders in the world for the past 5 years.
I think he's dropped off a little bit in the Prem. And I don't know if it's a, you know, not to be, like, too...
I think our form in general in the Prem is...
I don't think... I think you're right in terms of, like, over a season he peaked at Leicester and then in the first few seasons at Chelsea. but I also think at his best, he's still as good as he was then. Yeah. He just isn't sustaining it over the whole season.
Oh, no, I agree with that.
In terms of Lille, I think I haven't really watched them this season, but I caught a bit of them in their title run. And what I would say is, like, I think it might be a little bit harsh to go too hard in on them for this game. I know they're not doing well this season, but
it felt like they
were just up against a better team. Like, I mean, I think a big theme we're going to talk about today is how conceding or scoring a goal changes the nature of the game. And you talked about how Alex talked about how they set up in, like, a porous block, but I felt that once they conceded, they kind of changed up a little bit and actually got back into the game quite well. What I noticed, though, was that, I mean, Chelsea are just one of the best teams in Europe out of possession. And while I thought Chelsea were giving up a bit too much of the ball after their goal in the first half, the quality of shots that they were giving up to Lille were, like, nothing. Like, Lille were basically just taking really, really bad shots in bad areas. And Chelsea were completely resolute in defense, and I thought some of Lille's players just didn't look like they had the technical ability on the ball.
The thing is this, like, the reason I would blame Lille a little bit defensively was because, like, I mean, they conceded so many chances early on, and that
definitely bad before the goal.
And the goal kind of came from exactly what I was talking about, where they just exposed that left-hand side of theirs defensively. Pulisic was able to drive, tuck in to give Kai that chance. Kai cuts in, shoots, gets a corner, and that chance in and of itself was pretty good, and he scores off the corner. Like, you know what I mean? I don't know.
And he should have scored before that as well when he...
Yeah, exactly.
I think they started badly, but I think more my point is what I saw after that was a team that was trying to get back into the game and actually did well to get sustained periods of possession of the ball, but just couldn't really do anything with it. Like,
one thing
I noticed was, at least to me, it looks like they replaced Soumaré with a player who is not like for like. I think his name was Xhaka. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Xhaka, but he was there before. I mean, he played.
Okay,
much,
I mean, it looks like he's playing. It looks like he's playing where Soumaré would normally have played, next to Andre. Yeah. And I just felt like he seems like a different type of midfielder, not one who's gonna really get the ball on the floor and start breaking lines.
And neither is Andre, I think. I've not been that impressed. I know he's still young, but Inanna hasn't yet impressed me for the hype that he's kind of getting in Ligue 1. I felt that they did have a pretty... I would call it a loose midfield in terms of how tight those touches were, how tight it would progress through. With Andre, you know what you're going to get from him. You get an elite player who breaks up possession. And I feel like, to get the most out of him, because I do like him quite a lot as a player, you do need those players you can kind of carry and keep possession a bit better. So I do agree with you there. I don't think they improved that much. I think Chelsea were just very, very happy to let them do what they were going to do, because ultimately it was all very, very stale. Chelsea were never threatened. Chelsea are pretty comfortable out of possession.
Yeah, I do agree with that.
You know what, though? You guys are letting the out of possession, but for me, like, I think... the reason I want to mention this is because I think it falls into one of the key themes here that I've expressed to you guys, I think, is the case, but haven't really, I guess, like, publicized all too much, is that, like, I think, like, in possession, we were good, and in attack, we were much more... think about it. Kai got 3 shots in the box within the first 10 minutes. Like, I think we are, generally speaking, a better... like, systemically, a better attacking side with someone prototypically like Kai Havertz to be our number 9 than Lukaku.
This is exactly where I wanted to go. I want to know what you actually think of Kai as a 9 going forward.
I've always had this conversation with Orlando, one of our friends, as well as a few other kind of Chelsea friends from Twitter and stuff that we've talked about, that we all kind of in agreement. I mean, before we even bought Lukaku, we were like, Kai should be our number 9 for this next season. We shouldn't be spending... we don't need a number 9 as much as we need, like, let's say, another midfielder. Instead of getting someone like Saul, if we had bought someone like Tchouameni or even Declan Rice, but, like, Tchouameni, because he was, you know, this summer, pricing-wise, would have been cheaper. That would have been a greater benefit to the team holistically, we believe. That's not like a whole, oh, we'll see, we were right. Like, we all love Lukaku. We all think he's an amazing player. But even when he was playing well, the conversations were still... It just seems like, though, that we're kind of shoehorning him in rather than him actually, and he's just a good player, so it's working out. But now you can see, once you start playing against the top sides, that it doesn't work that well. Why is that, right? Well, firstly, obviously, like, the support from the wingbacks, definitely would have helped Lukaku if it was still existent. Alonso, Aspi, not, you know, Chilwell and Reese clearly as attacking output are much better wingbacks. And we have almost no kind of central midfield central support in the attack. It's almost completely reliant on the front three. Sometimes, if we're playing very ball dominant, the center backs can kind of help and add an extra man in midfield. And we're lucky to have guys like Rudiger, Thiago Silva, who are like pretty skilled on the ball as well. But it's mainly the wingbacks, who, again, are pretty depleted now due to injuries, and our front three. And our front three, then, because they get isolated a lot of times, need to be, like, fluid ball carriers. Need to be, like, Kai Havertz, everyone always talked about him being so versatile and being able to fit into so many different positions. And yes, definitely at Leverkusen, he can do a solid level at pretty much so many different positions. But he's so good at doing all these different things, starting from a nine position, then starting from another position and doing, attacking mid type role or like winger type role things. It's much better when you give him that free striker role and allow him to kind of play in any kind of little niche position or role he wants to do when he starts from that nine and he just has the freedom to roam.
Yeah, I definitely. Why
I pretty much agree.
Why do you think it's not worked out for him just behind the striker? Because I mean, it's not only a case that he's working well at the nine, it's that he hasn't been working well behind a striker.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's kind of weird. Like under Lampard, for sure, if we were running 4-2-3-1, I definitely think, because at times Lampard especially would use that, that attacking mid behind the striker, almost like a shadow striker. I mean, we saw the combination early on when Kai scored the hat trick don't get me wrong, it was against Barnsley at the time, but that's when he really like had his first kind of cameo where he was like, people were like, wow, this guy's really good. It was a link up between him and Tammy. He needs someone he can link up with in that sense, and he can play in that shadow striker type role. In this system, he either plays winger / a second split striker, and if he plays a split striker, like, I thought that could work. I think maybe it's just because although he is best as a nine, he's best as a free nine and not like a support nine. I have the misconception of thinking he could emulate what like a Lautaro Martinez is, and I do think skill set wise, it's not like he's incapable skill set wise, it's that clearly the kind of competency and ability to do that,
yeah,
he's
not so
like
sure.
Lautaro, you don't think Lautaro has real like goal scoring chops, and I'm not sure what
I'm talking about to support someone like Lukaku.
Well,
I'm not talking about
no,
just his ability
well I think
to score
the
goals.
Thing is, it's kind of weird because Kai, and I mean, I don't want to exhaust this for too long, but I think you had a good description of him as a player, but to me the thing with Kai Havertz is that he seems like he's best when he's playing almost not necessarily with his back to goal, but when he's playing in close proximity with other players.
Yeah.
And Chelsea are a very, like, I don't want to say transitional-based side, because you guys have a lot of possession periods. But when you have a 10 like Mount or someone like that, you're going to get a lot more, like, just natural creativity, progression, funneling, a lot more centrality than you get with Havertz. Havertz feels more like a guy who's going to do the on-ball stuff you want from a 9, but then you want someone else who's going to cover by kind of running beyond him, and he's got, I feel like he's not like a high-end playmaker or goal scorer in terms of like he's gonna get 20 goals, 20 assists in a season, but
yeah,
what he does really well is he's got good ability in tight spaces, really reads possession sequences well, he's got good physicality in terms of like just all around being able to handle defenders, and he's got really good gravity because when he has the ball, he's good enough at playmaking that you have to close him down.
Yeah,
and that opens up space for other guys to run, which is why I think it works so well when you have guys like Pulisic and Werner who thrive at open space and transition.
Right, but that's kind of where I was.
All right. I want to move on. We have four matches to get through.
I do think we mostly agree, though.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to discuss more, but I mean, I do disagree with Aaron. I think he could be a player who does get about 20 goals a season. I don't know if you meant in the league or across competitions.
League, yeah, league.
Oh, league, maybe not.
I mean, that's tough, yeah.
Yeah. And I wouldn't hold that against him, but...
Yeah.
I mean, would Lautaro get 20 in the league?
When I was comparing to Lautaro, it was not about his goal scoring. It was more so in terms of a support striker. That's Lukaku.
I think I do want to leave it. I have different sort of things just in terms of, I think, what Lautaro does off ball, out of possession. And I'm
yes,
not even imagining
exactly.
Lautaro. No, but I think that there are differences in what Lautaro can do defensively.
Right. No, that's what that's what I'm saying. I think it's a competency thing, like that Kai doesn't all have right. developed that Lautaro does.
Episode of FP90 without Lautaro. All I ask for.
We'll one never episode. Happen. One episode without Aaron running from this discussion. All right. So Aaron, Villarreal 1-1 with Juventus. I know you had some thoughts. So yeah, you take me through it.
Oh, this game happened on Tuesday. Yeah, so I mean, this is the last game I watched of the four, and I was very tired when I logged on this morning to try and watch this game, and I looked at the lineups as I always do before I start the game, and I saw 7 fullbacks, which I was not happy about. Mike and I discussed this a bit before you came into the call, Alex, but I feel like the fact that Juventus scored a goal so early kind of shifted the plans for both teams. Villarreal starting without a striker, playing a front two of Lo Celso and Danjuma, and then having to sort of break down an Allegri team with that front two, felt like they struggled to... I think they created enough to warrant the draw. Mike said he thought they could have won the game. I kind of agree, but I also feel like they didn't take it into overdrive, really. It felt like they were designed to play a 0-0 out.
So,
and it felt like both managers wanted this game to be cagey, so it was just cagey. There were long periods of possession that led to nothing, transitions that sort of led to corners that led to nothing, a lot of like midfielders passing it around, a lot of like Rabiot doing weird things because he couldn't, like, it was just a super disciplined game, and I feel like that's not really what Rabiot is. And it didn't really sparkle, in my opinion, but I think you guys enjoyed the game more than me, so.
I mean, I enjoyed the game. I think one of the things that I found quite interesting right off the beginning is that we thought we were going to see sort of Desquilio or Danilo as the right centre-back, as the left centre-back, then Sandro at left-back, and, yeah.
Cuadrado on the wing.
Yeah. Well, right wing, left wing. But yeah, I found it quite interesting right from the beginning that they actually had Desilio at left back.
It was a back three.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of a back three, but...
it was like, in reality, they put like a 4-3, 4-5-3-2 or like
a 5-4-1 the entire game. It depends, because there was a lot of the game that Sandro was playing as part of the back three, and then there was a lot of the game that Desilio was playing as part of the back three.
Yeah, it was weird. I don't know. It felt like they thought I actually thought on paper the difference between these two sides. I've watched a fair bit of Villarreal. They've got some good players. I felt like the difference on paper between these two teams is actually not as big as you would expect for a Villarreal Juventus tie. And that probably has something to do with how Juventus have recruited and retained players over the last few years, but it seemed like Allegri thought Villarreal would be difficult to break down, and then he would have to set up so that they would control the game but also be really cagey out of possession, because that's his priority, and then not let them in but slowly break them down over 90 minutes. And then Vlahovic suddenly goes and scores in the first minute, and suddenly that's out of the window. And Villarreal's plan to defend and play in transitions the whole game is also out of the window.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Suddenly it becomes a lot of playmaking for kind of... It felt like there was not enough occupation of Juve's center backs for a lot of it, and it felt like neither team really wanted the game to be in that state. Or, I mean, no, Juventus obviously wanted to be ahead, but that's not what they had planned for, because they weren't expecting to get a break so early.
Yeah. Go for it.
No, I was just going to say that, I don't know, like, I think, like we talked about, Aaron, like, I think them scoring first, Juventus scoring first definitely changed the game. Villarreal can be like, they kind of impressed me, you know, what to in the sense of like how they were approaching the block. I think, like you said, though, a striker presence felt like it was lacking because they went up early and allowed Juventus to sit and make the game cagey. Juventus started just switching the play pretty consistently, just playing direct passes when drawing out Villarreal's like counter press, and literally just they'd win the ball back, play it out wide, and then play like a direct pass over the top, like 3-4 passes in their sequence of possession, pretty much, and that was like their general opportunities that they would create. Villarreal, to be fair, had an interesting, like, I think that they tried a methodical approach post-fact, like, after they conceded, where they had the combos on the left side, as we spoke about, between Moreno, Pedraza, and Danjuma, and then they left the right side a little more open with Chukwueze to be able to run direct. So the left side was filled with kind of combos, and it's actually where, you know, one of their first chance actually came, where Lu Cecil hit the crossbar. They had... They won the ball back from their counter press after progressing the ball to the left side, and two of the Juventus back defenders committed to the same ball, leaving the gap really open. I believe it was Pedraza picked it up, drove into that space, played it to Lo Celso. That was something, and that's even how the goal was scored. I felt like although Juve were sitting deep and all that stuff, like, I was really unimpressed by the organization of their back line, because it felt like they did, like, I mean, for how many numbers they had, it felt like they weren't on the same page. That goal they conceded was really poor. Rabiot was not tracking. Two of their defenders were clustered up as well, like, to leave that gap so big. Pereira had just an easy walkthrough. The only reason I say I think they could have won the game was because they had the Lo Celso chance and the Capu chance. The Capu chance came from Chukwueze running straight at the fullback and stuff and beating him and creating a pretty good chance.
Just to quickly touch upon what you kind of... So I think what Mike and I kind of discussed before was when you see someone like Alberto Moreno, who's a fullback by trade, playing at left mid, you expect them to build in something like a 3-2-5, which is three center backs with the left back joining the back three, two central midfielders, and then a front five. But what they actually did was more like Capoue or Parejo dropping into the back three, and then Moreno moving into central midfield, and Pedraza overlapping him. So what that did was the Moreno moves inside, and then Pedraza goes forward, and Danjuma pulls wide, and it forces you to have three guys, two in the half space and one on the wing, and it gives them an extra man to deal with, and then they can switch it quickly and create an overload.
So this is actually what I wanted to talk about. I mean, I think basically what this comes down to is it's an issue I've had with Emery since he went to PSG. I actually used to be a big fan of his before he went to PSG, and I kind of saw how he couldn't really make that step up with a bigger team, right? He always likes to kind of play that underdog role. Is that you can kind of see, I mean, these are two managers who really like planning versus the other manager, what the other manager is going to do. And I think, as Mikey pointed out, Chukwueze was the clear threat on the right. What did Allegri do? He actually had Decilio playing inverted, because Chukwueze is great, but he can only really play off his left. He doesn't have a right foot to switch to, right? So they largely nullified that. I think he gave Decilio quite a tough time, but I think they got through with it. But then on the other side, it's just, it was so easy to contain because you had Moreno. You had Pedraza creating this nice channel for Moreno to kind of attack every time. But Moreno's, you know, as good as he is an attacking force for someone who is like a left wing back, I don't think he doesn't have that threat of that inside channel run. And I think it's this sort of thing that I really think, I agree with you that, you know, that those teams actually matched up pretty well. And it's just, Emery doesn't have that sort of, I would say, bravery or willingness to try kill the opposition or take it to the opposition.
In fairness to him, though, I do think he just happens to be coaching one of the worst teams remaining. Especially if they go through, they might be the worst team in the quarterfinal. So I just think when you have on the pitch, like, there's going to be, like, you're looking at, as long as, barring upsets, there's going to be Ajax, PSG, Bayern, Chelsea, City, Liverpool. Like, they're not as good as those teams, however, we differently rate. I think my point is that when you have that kind of disadvantage, having a manager like Emery can be really good because he's going to make the game difficult for anyone come up against.
That's true.
And possibly give them a chance of a win. And that's how they won the Europa League, and they're going to do it again here. So
I don't disagree there at all. I just think when there's that sort of opportunity, especially the way they dominated possession, they have players like Parejo. They have good players. And obviously Danjuma this season's gone through the roof. They didn't even really try to actually take it to the opposition. I mean, the first half, they were the dominant team, but Juve were very, very comfortable. I think in the second half, Juve's own performance is kind of what allowed. I mean, the goal that they scored was absolutely amateurish from Juve. But I don't think it's something that Villarreal pushed for. They weren't forcing mistakes. They they got like a very, very easy goal because Rabiot was ball watching. All three centre backs were on Danjuma. Yeah.
They should play a striker, in my opinion, and then if put Marcelo at left mid. But like I said, I don't think they knew that they would go down 1-0 so early.
I also think like part of it was like we were talking about. That's what Emery planned for, right? He assumed that irrespective of going down, like he didn't expect to go down earlier because it made it even more tough to break them down since of how deep they were. But I think he played guys like Danjuma and Lo Celso, particularly Lo Celso being able to kind of tuck into midfield, which is where he dropped off quite often, to be able to move around that line. Because I think if it was 0-0 for the majority of the game like they played, they would have had a really good like a good time exploiting Juve. I really think they would have done a good job doing that.
Okay, here's my question for you guys.
Why didn't he make a sub at 60 minutes then?
Yeah, it's a little different. I can't rationalize every... I mean, I'm sure there's a reason. He's obviously like a pretty good coach. But like,
because he's a coward.
I can't rationalize everything.
The honest, he's a great coach. I think he's a very good coach. I just think he doesn't have that... You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know if maybe he had the profile. Like Moreno... Is Gerard Moreno injured? Because he wasn't even on the bench.
No, Gerard Moreno's injured. But Jeremy Pino... Yeah. What's his name?
Yeah, but Pino's not a striker, no? He's a
winger. No. They had a striker on the bench, though. Marino. Yeah, Dia.
No, but they had a number 9 on the bench.
They had Dia? About Dia? Yeah.
But I'm saying Marino...
So, I mean,
Marino,
I would even, as early as halftime, just take out Moreno as an Alberto and then bring on the striker and push Lo Celso deep.
But anyways, hit us with your question, Aaron.
I was going to say, I think this is one of the close ties, so who do you guys think has the upper hand going into the second leg?
I think Villarreal's going to... Well, I don't know. They're away, but I want them to win.
I think they could have won this game if they'd been braver. I think Juventus will win the return trial.
I hope
especially,
not.
They have centre-backs coming back. I mean, one of the big things is that why they could have taken it to them, I mean, I forgot to make that point earlier, is because they literally had Danilo as one of their centre-backs. And then you're putting up, like Marino against them. I think, and not Gerard, Alberto. I mean, I think when it comes back to the second half in 3 weeks, Bonucci's going to be back. I think Chiellini might be coming back. I don't really see it, and I think Allegri licks his lips at the idea of protecting, you know,
for sure,
or holding up. And Juventus.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely mad. There's no more away goals, but yeah.
I think my concern with Juventus long term is that it felt like. I mean, I didn't think McKennie was bad in this game, but it felt like Locatelli is kind of holding the fort in midfield a lot. It doesn't feel like they can really take games to teams in midfield, and I think that's going to be a difficult problem going forward.
I do want to say one thing before I run away, but I didn't think Locatelli had the best game that he'll ever have.
Not particularly in this one, but I, neither did I Rabiot. Do think neither overall did
Rabiot.
He's there.
Rabiot
he's
was
the
terrible,
kind of
but
guy
I mean,
holding the fort.
Yeah. I'm. You don't point out Rabiot as being bad because he often is.
He's just not
you
that
know?
Good.
Yeah. Or at least not.
No, but
that
he was just like that goal for Parejo. I was like, bro, like come on, like turn your head just a little
all,
bit.
All three center backs were.
I know.
That amount of space to for a central like deep line midfielder who didn't make that many runs to find that much space in a deep block in the Champions League.
I do want to call this because you know before I don't want them to take my hosting abilities away. So yeah, we're gonna have a short break and then we'll get on to Wednesday's games. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the Football Per 90 podcast, where I'm still joined by Mike Nazarian and Aaron Winters. So now we're going to be speaking about the Wednesday games, and I think I'm going to come to Mikey first to talk about what I think was the most exciting match of these first legs, which was Benfica 2, Ajax 2. I want to know, Mike, what did you think of the first half in particular?
Yeah, I think, Ajax, I think, like, we're obviously the more dominant team, and you know, doing it in their traditional kind of like high octane attacking side, like they have some absurd goal difference numbers this season so far. They press aggressively. They have some really nice slick combos that help them create chances and have good movement in the box. Haller's been playing out of his mind in the Champions League, and we saw his goal actually came from kind of a similar circumstance. One of the things I saw with them as well, though, as a result, was they were also aggressively committing numbers forward. And that was a lot of fun to watch from a neutral perspective, because although Ajax are, like, you know, like they are the more dominant side in this fixture, it also allowed for Benfica to manufacture a lot of their chances this way, and that's how they were really able to create a lot of high quality chances and score. Well, I guess mainly the second goal came from this, and they had a few chances. The first goal wasn't as much a transitional opportunity, but regardless, Benfica being able to hit on the break was what made for a really, really exciting game and left Ajax exposed, you know, to a lot of those kinds of opportunities.
I mean, 100%, especially, I think, you know, that we saw how much they got punished for it in the second half in particular. Yeah. With just how far Timber was committing forwards, that's where the second goal came from. And they had a couple of heart and mouth moments before that even. But yeah, I want to know, like, Aaron, what do you think actually really changed in that second half? Because from how I watched, I mean, Ajax really had the first half under control. Benfica had some nice moments. I think their pivot of Weigl and Tarab was a great way of them being able to actually attack quickly in the first half. But it changed in a big way in the second half. And interested to know what you kind of saw as what changed.
Yeah, I mean, Ajax are a bit of a juggernaut in the sense that I think they can kind of play a game at any style. So if you pin them back, they can still find their opportunities and play on the break. And if you let them have the ball, they can break you down slowly and surely. And I think Benfica sort of realized at some point that they had the squad to play kind of ideally against them. And then by bringing on Yaremchuk, they kind of took that to the next gear. So really physical strikers who can go one-to-one with their center backs and buy opportunities in transition, some nice carrying into the open space if they can beat the press, and then two midfielders in Weigl and Tarapt who can beat the press. And really, like, Tarapt is known for his sort of on-ball skills and just, like, pulling off different skills and hitting balls into open space. Weigl is, like, a pretty much classic deep-lying playmaker. Lots of these, like, switch balls and line-breaking passes. And it just allowed them to get a lot of opportunities on the break. With respect to... go ahead.
No, I think I want to break those two separate points apart, because I think both are worth looking at quite a lot. I think first we're speaking about that midfield. I mean, Weigl and Tarab's actually probably the most enjoyable midfields I've watched in a while. I really want to watch more Benfica because of it. I know that this was just Tarab, his first start of the Champions League campaign. Apparently he's only started three more times this season. But it was... Yeah, I think it was a big thing that their manager got right. They managed to kind of... I mean, Ajax was so good pushing them on the wings. That's how Benfica actually tried to start out with their play early on, going especially through Grimaldo in the build-up, and then they just realized Ajax were too quick. Antony and Tadic were on top of both of their fullbacks every time playing out from the back, that they had to kind of go long, which worked better. But then it was specifically having those midfielders who can just kind of go tunnel it through the middle in that, like, second phase of possession and then send it out wide that really, really made the difference for them in the first half.
I mean, the other thing with Ajax is, so I thought Benfica defended all right, and I didn't think they got rolled over or Ajax should have scored like 10 goals or anything, but I do think they had a couple of points where they could have put chances away and made Benfica look a little bit make them look a little bit more rewarded for committing those numbers forward. Like, I know the one where Alvarez hit the post and Haller missed the rebound.
Yeah.
There was a ball that came to Mazraoui. I felt in a really good position, and it was just on his left foot, so he didn't get enough around the ball. There were a couple of moments where, in a different game, you think Ajax might blow that into 3-1, 4-1, and then you're looking at the tie going, it's over, so Ajax are justified in committing those numbers. But that didn't happen, and Benfica kind of held together well and readjusted with the Yaremchuk sub and got going on the other end. And yeah, I mean, it makes the second leg of this tie really interesting, because Benfica kind of feel like they have Ajax. They have a good setup to beat Ajax, but Ajax are obviously still the favorites and, in my opinion, one of the best teams in the competition.
Actually, yeah, I felt that... I mean, I think it was a clear sort of thing when... I thought Everton had a pretty decent game before he got taken off. But then I was surprised to see him getting taken off instead of the number 88, Goncalo... I can't remember his surname. his first start. But I think it kind of was a clear sign from their manager that they just wanted to use the height and physicality to kind of bomb down. They actually had Darwin Nunez playing the left wing there, and even playing almost a shift when they were out of position, they were sitting in a very solid 5-4-1 with Darwin Núñez actually at the left back for some crazy reason. So, but I mean, on that note, what did you guys actually think of Darwin Núñez? Because he's in the news a lot. I've only watched him a couple of times now. This is by far, that second half was the most I've been impressed by him.
I think he was super involved in the game, and I think he was unlucky to not get a goal. I remember he had one chance particularly. I was most impressed by Rafa Silva, as kind of mentioned to you guys a little earlier, because, I mean, like, in terms of spearheading those transitional chances, he was at the helm of all of it pretty much. But yeah, I think he was a little unlucky to not get a goal. I think I need to watch a little bit more of him before I make any kind of judgments, but, like, he definitely seems like, in terms of his build and his skill set, like, he can be a menace. Like, I just don't know how high of a, like, he sounds like kind of a, like if I was a, like, I mean, I'm not big, but even if I was a big center back playing against him, like, I'd be a little, I'd be put off by, like, having to come up against this guy continuously, because he's definitely, like, a physical specimen.
He's not quite like a traditional goal scoring nine type. He's more of like a hybrid forward. He kind of reminds me, I've watched him only two or three times, but my first impression is kind of a lot like what Mikhail Antonio has been doing for West Ham this season, where he's this, like, he has the physicality and the ability to hold up off the nine, off the shoulder of the center back, and also run the half spaces, like get into the channels and make runs, receive and release and transition. But he also has a little bit of a, like, creative playmaking side, where he likes to pick up the ball in front of the defense. And that's what we saw from the left, where he picks up the ball in front of the fullback and runs at them a little bit.
It's so funny you mentioned the Mikel Antonio comparison, because I think he is actually linked with West Ham.
Yeah, I think he is. I think he is. I think it's interesting, because Antonio's fitness is not great. As much as he's one of my favorite strikers in the Premier League, they do struggle a lot when he's out. And yeah, I mean, I think you could actually see Darwin Núñez in the Premier League. And I think he's more of, like, I wouldn't put him in a role where you want him to be the number nine and just stay up front and basically fight for chances and move around between the edges of the 18-yard box. But what I would have him for is just a role where he has a little bit of freedom to pull off the striker, or sorry, to pull off the center backs, make plays, roam a little bit, and yeah, I mean, it just
put himself around.
Very well-rounded player. Yeah.
Thing I wanted to ask about, I don't want to, like, change the topic, but it was because, like, it was something I wanted to see your guys' opinion on a little bit as well, because one thing that I noted for sure was Benfica as a team, I think their organization was maybe not, I don't know, maybe this is to Ajax's, this is what I want to ask you guys, maybe it's to Ajax's credit, maybe it was to Benfica's, you know, like, inability to be as defensively organized as maybe they should have been. I felt like Ajax clearly are really good on the ball, Ajax clearly can move around the ball really swiftly, and I think what I saw Benfica doing quite a bit was they would cluster a lot in the midfield and condense it, which left the wide areas pretty open, and, like, we were seeing combos on the left side, and then similar to what we were talking about from the Villarreal section, I saw Antony on the right side getting a lot of isolation, which is what you want from a guy like him. I just felt like a lot of times when they were condensing the mid, they were overcommitting and leaving gaps that created space for Ajax to exploit with those combos.
In the first half, for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
I noticed that. Less so in the second half. I think first half it was very, very clear. I mean, Antony had the first 20 minutes. I think he was the star of the first 20 minutes, the way he had Grimaldo on the ropes the entire time. I mean, I'd actually have to watch it back and look, but I'm not entirely sure why, but I think Benfica really became a lot better in the second half. I mean, I think Grimaldo, for one, just his personal performance upped a lot in the second half. Part of it was not getting put under so much pressure deep in possession, which I think he was getting caught out with how quick Antony was on him every time the keeper was trying to make those sort of diagonal passes to him. But yeah, I'm not actually entirely sure.
I honestly just think Ajax are really difficult to defend against. They kind of play in these two triangles. It's sort of like you have Alvarez in the middle of two triangles, where Berghaus is playing 10 and he kind of stretches to the right, and then Gravenberch joins him on the left. So you have these triangles. One is Blind, Gravenberch, and Tadic, and the other one is Mazraoui, Berghaus, and Antony, and they rotate so well between the three of them. by having the inside midfielder and the winger kind of switch spots or make runs to open the space, and then the fullbacks make these really good runs into the vacant spaces, and they're really good at like picking out where they can run to hurt the opposition. So it's just so hard, even if you have those two banks of four, to not get moved around by them. And then the pace that they play, like, I don't think there's some of the pace of Ajax's possessions, like, I don't think there's many teams moving the ball around that quickly. I mean, like, very few. They just get the ball from side to side so quickly and then just move into the vacant spaces.
Yeah, I guess it was just more so about how much, it's just how much they let, like, it seemed like they were clustering in the mid much more than just, like, being moved around. And that's where I was like, it seems like, for sure, assignment-wise. Yeah. Assignment-wise, you're like, you could be confused, and then you end up kind of marking the same person. But it was more like, I just feel like they didn't optimize the space. They were being too tight in terms of the numbers they had to cover in Ajax's central areas, I felt, where it was almost like they wanted it to go out wide and then press, but Ajax has moved the ball so quickly that it actually was not helpful to do it that way.
I think a lot of Ajax's chances in the first half also came from high regains, so that comes from issues Benfica were having playing out of pressure, and that's where Weigl and Tarapt really came up big later in the game, where they were helping Benfica keep the ball a lot better. But yeah, I mean, I think, but all said and done, when you look at the squad quality and how well Ajax have been playing, I think Benfica did well in this match.
Yeah, I mean, I think I will just restate. I think that Benfica had them far more controlled in the wide areas, as much as you can for Ajax, against Ajax in the second half. I mean, I think there were one or two moments where Ajax did a lot better kind of exploiting those inside channels, especially Gravenberch going forward had a very good game. Not so sure about defensively, but that was probably the main places they threatened, whereas in the first half, they really had them everywhere. Mazraia was making wide runs the whole time. Last thing before I think we want to move on, but I think we shouldn't speak about, in my opinion, probably the man of the match and the man who dominated the second half. And I know you wanted to speak about him, but Rafa Silva, Mikey?
Yeah, no, I touched on him a little bit. I just felt like he was really spearheading all those transition opportunities. Like, he's absolutely rapid. I wonder if he'll move somewhere else. I don't know exactly how old he is. He's been around for a little bit. 28. No? Yeah, he's been around for a little bit, exactly. So I couldn't imagine him moving to I'm not saying anything like serious team, but like I would like to see him maybe in a more regularly watched league, I guess. Like, you know, I don't watch Portuguese football as much as, you know, maybe some other people, but it'd be cool to see him in a top five league and stuff. And well, I guess, I don't know, Portugal.
I mean, he's playing Champions League knockout football and knocking Barca.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking that.
It's tough. I was thinking about a better deal than what you have at Benfica when you're a 28-year-old winger. But yeah,
I was thinking about that in the context of Otamendi. I was like, this guy moved to Benfica and he's still playing Champions League, actually. So maybe he enjoys it in that sense. You still get the best of both worlds.
He's also 34, so he...
Yeah, I know, for sure. I'm aware.
But yeah, but I mean, I think what impressed me about Rafa Silva, and also I haven't watched that much of him over the years, it's just how good his deliveries are and how well-timed his deliveries are. I mean, I think he had that whole Ajax left-hand side on toast. Actually, to the point that Erik ten Hag, I think he made both subs in order to kind of contain Rafa Silva's impact in the second half with the Tagliafico on for Blintz, and then who was it, Klaassen on for Gravenberch, actually just to kind of hunker down that side because fresh, I mean, Blintz, yeah, I mean, Blintz not that athletic to start with, and I think obviously struggled with Wayne as the game went on, and then I think Gravenberch still has an issue with tracking his runners and actually taking up good defensive positions as good as he is on the ball and going forward. With that said, I think, what do you guys, oh yeah, before I go on, but what do you guys think of the second leg? I mean, I personally think it's going to be an Ajax win.
Yeah, I think Ajax is going to take it.
It's Ajax's to lose for sure. I do think Benfica are doing a good job. Like I said, they're playing all the cards to make it difficult. So if Ajax slip up, they're there to capitalize. But yeah, overall, Ajax should get it done.
They should start Yaremchuk, I think, from the beginning.
Absolutely.
And obviously Darwin Nunez again.
And go long to him as well. If they're struggling in build-up, Yaremchuk is great to go long to. Like, at the Euros, a big reason why Ukraine were able to get so far was because they were just going long.
They were also going through...
They have some good build-up... Yeah. Sorry, yeah. They have some good build-up patterns. I don't want to dismiss them. Yeah. But, yeah, I just know we have to move on. But, yeah, I think it's nice to have that plan B when you're stuck under a press, to be able to go long to a target man and bring others into play.
And I think that's what the Benfica coach kind of came out with very strongly after the first 30 minutes or so, where their normal, or how I assume their normal build-up was just not working at all. But yeah, second match, and I know this is Aaron's one to speak. Disclaimer, well, not disclaimer, but truth be told, I was made host today because my team isn't yet in the Champions League, yeah. Either of them. So, so yeah, Aaron, what was it, 1-1 Atleti versus Man United.
Yeah, very talk frustrating game as a United fan. But, I mean, I think that's what Atleti do. They pretty much played an Atleti knockout game, and United faced their usual struggles. So, I mean, yeah, Atleti's biggest chance creator was their press. They were winning the ball high and taking advantage of United that way. The usual, they don't let margins slip on set pieces and stuff like that, just constantly making it difficult at every opportunity they can. And then when they score, they sort of drop off, and I think as the game went on, United began to get a little bit more into it. United have, we'll get on to United in a second, but basically Atleti sort of dropped off, and I think that's ultimately what let United back into the game more than United figuring out how to exploit them. There were a couple of other things United did, but yeah, for the most part, it just felt like a typical Atleti recent years Champions League performance where they try to run their low block and high press, and something kind of undoes it, and they get unlucky, or they overdo it, in my opinion, and don't get the rewards for their defensive work.
And Mikey, any of your thoughts on the game?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think this game kind of played out the way I thought it was, like, going to, where, you know, I think Atleti did a pretty good job also, like, I think there's a lot of, it seems like United trying to fit under Ranić ball is a little chaotic right now, because it is intense, and so to get that intensity down to a refined level is tough. And there's two examples I saw of it that I just want to talk about. Well, the first goal that Atleti scored, actually, was United's back line off the corner immediately trying to push out. What happened was Lodi dusted Fred, though, completely, and the back line... Oh, okay. I thought, well, yeah. Was it a slip because of Lodi, or was it a slip
he just... No. He was running out to cover the pass back from Lodi, I think.
Yeah.
And then he slipped.
So, because Lodi took a heavy touch. Lodi did this time and time. Lodi was an absolute menace this game. Like, I was so impressed by him. But, like, he pushed heavy into the space, slinged in a beautiful ball. The back line, because of Fred, or because they were trying to push out on the corner, like, realistically, right? You, like, the ball goes out of the box off a corner, you want to push out to not just be pinned into your box. But once he got past that first line, he was able to play a free ball in, played an amazing ball. The back line had already walked out, and so João Félix was making that run.
Yeah.
Amazing athletic effort as well by him, beautiful header. But to the credit of United, one thing that was also Ranić ball, I guess, was when they scored their goal, actually, it was real quick. Like, I think Maguire headed the ball, immediately went to Fred, Sancho, then Ronaldo was even involved, back to Fred again, then back to Bruno. It was quick combo movements on that left-hand side that played it out to Bruno and into that space. And Alanya was making that run then, which, again, like, I think if you watch it back, I see Sancho making a run on the left side. If Bruno saw him, and I think he was technically in a better position, because that ball to play to Alanya was tough. But it worked out, obviously, and he scored.
Also, yeah. Well, Reinildo really messed that up.
Yeah, for sure he did. Yeah, for sure he did. No.
Early, yeah. Mistiming it, and then...
He still played, like, Bruno still played a good ball. It was messed up, though, and it was a tougher ball to play.
Oblak should have made it more difficult as well. But I want to go back to the point about Atleti's goal, because I think it's kind of symptomatic of the issues United had in this game, where I do think Maguire should deal with that better. Like, I think Felix creates that separation too easily. And Maguire's usually pretty good at aerial situations like that. So, I mean, but I think the ultimate solution is United can't be conceding that many crossing situations, against a top team. Like, the whole thing starts because, and I don't blame a player for losing the ball 10 passes before a goal, because I think that's silly, but the whole thing starts because De Gea receives the ball in space and just boots it out of play. And then Atleti have a throw in the final third. And the whole thing is, I think United are really struggling to build exit pressure consistently and gain some momentum in the final third. because they can't, they just can't consistently get there. Like, a lot of people are talking about the Pogba performance. He didn't have the ball in areas where Paul Pogba's known for anyways.
Aaron, I want to ask you about that, because, like, well, not about Pogba, but what you're talking about in terms of the defensive stuff. So you say, like, you were talking about, like, oh, I expect Maguire to do a little bit better there. But I see, like, I think it's what I was kind of mentioning earlier, where, like, there's this almost chaotic nature, like, even in the press, right? Like, both in terms of the way they want to move the ball quickly when they have the ball, and both in the way that they want to press when they don't have the ball. That intensity, I feel like there's a lot of kind of chaotic nature to it, where, like I said, I think the back line was just aggressively trying to push out, and in earlier positions wasn't as good, it made it tough for the back. You can't recover that as easily.
Yeah.
And Maguire's especially not a good player to recover in that way.
It's a bit of a muddy situation because it's recovering from a set piece, but I think the real, at least from what I saw, the real problem with conceding these situations is United just don't, like, they don't get, they're aggressive, but there are just gaps in the personnel and in the implementation right now.
It just seems so reactive still, these presses. I think,
so my personal, and this is my speculation, is that there's a lot of just big, high-profile names that just don't really fit what Rangnick is trying to do. Yeah. Even if they, I mean, you can debate all, we can debate all day about whether De Gea and Ronaldo are good players. And the midfield is a mess, no matter who plays. But when they're on the pitch, there are just so many more issues playing against these teams that United just can't solve. And it doesn't seem like it's Rangnick's choice to put them on the pitch. It feels like he has to play them. Because if he drops De Gea or he drops Ronaldo, it's front page news. And he's dropping expensive players. And it just feels like United need to, like, gut those players. If United played what I feel is the best 11 to play under Rangnick, like, even the Elanga goal, it came because there was finally a striker who was actually making a run in behind, yeah, and not asking for the ball. You said Ronaldo was involved in the sequence. Yeah. That's because Ronaldo keeps asking for the ball.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
There was finally a guy who was going to make a run behind and actually make an impact to receive from Sancho, Pogba, Bruno. And that's what leads to scoring goals. So if you want to reap the rewards of United's best players and Rangnick's coaching, you need to play the right players, and no, you need to, sure, get them all on the for pitch. Sure. And yeah. So Aaron, I just feel like United aren't going to do that, which is why they're not going to...
Let's say you're a manager for the next one. What would your team be for the return leg, and what do you think the score is going to be?
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, I don't think you can fix build-up from the midfield, but I get Pogba out of build-up. I get him as the most advanced midfielder and bring back McTominay. McTominay was hurt, or he was ill, so he couldn't play this. But I'd bring back McTominay, push Fred further forward, and push Pogba further forward. Then I would play Bruno up front, because if our striker is going to ask for the ball every time, it might as well be someone who can do something with the ball. Bruno, Ronaldo, and Rashford together is just a cocktail of horrible decisions in possession that make it difficult for United to sustain pressure. Mm-hmm. So I would keep Bruno because he's the one who makes the most impact. And then you want to get Elanga on.
I didn't think Bruno had that great of a game, though. He was losing the ball.
He wasn't. No, he was losing the ball too much. But he's of the three, he's the one who makes the most impact.
Oh, for sure.
If you reduce his role in possession, I think he's also possibly the one who has the highest goal-scoring pedigree right now.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, that's a terrible indictment on Ronaldo and Rashford, that Bruno's a better goal scorer than them. But it's
the I remember watching one spell of actually pretty good possession in, like, around the 36th minute or so. And then Ronaldo just shooting from a terrible position. Yeah. So and Pogba, it was like, dude, the one time you guys had some actually, like Maguire bombed forward a little bit. They were moving the ball back and forth. And then Ronaldo just was like, cool, I'll get this ball 40 yards out and just have a rip and completely miss.
I think I tweeted, like, at nice, that point, like, nice, at Letty's center backs in the first half might as well just have had a cup of coffee. Because they just had to watch Elanga and, or not Elanga, Rashford and Sancho out wide. And they just had to follow the offside line. They had no one occupying the center. So you can play, and you can play 20 creators, and you can keep blaming them, like Pogba and Sancho, and to a lesser extent Bruno. Or you can have someone who's going to get on the end of those chances, right? So I just think you got to play Elanga, because Cavani was out. I'm going to give Rangnick the benefit of the doubt on Dalo, because if he's fit, I'm sure he would have played. You got to get McTominay and Fred back in midfield, and get Pogba and Sancho on the ball in the best areas, with Bruno and Elanga connecting it together and actually being able to receive and get on the end of chances. If United do that, I make them favorites. But
okay, and Aaron and Mikey, what do you think? In the return leg back at Old Trafford,
The United return leg? No, I agree. I think I mean, from the beginning, like, in on the general scheme of things, I think Rangnick just needs to play players that fit the system better. I completely agree that I think Ronaldo, Bruno, whatever, like, just don't fit. And I think if they go forward with that, like, Atleti was unlucky to not win this game. Like, you know, like, I think Manu only had, like, 0.4 XG to Atletico's 1.3. Like, so I think, like, you know, I think Atletico is going to win. I thought they were going to win from the beginning just because, although Atletico has not been, like, phenomenal this season, particularly I think their squad has gotten better, you know, adding certain names that probably haven't performed as much, like, to the degree I thought. That, like, for example, I thought Rodrigo De Paul was going to come in and immediately start killing it in this Atletico side. But, you know, irrespective of that, I think Atletico, you know, are still the better team, and more so to the fact that there's this still chaotic nature about Manchester United that I think Atletico can exploit, and so long as they stay defensively resilient, I don't think United's going
to
score.
I'm going to caveat what I said about United. Sorry. I'm going to caveat what I said about United playing their best players in that I don't think they will, and that's why I would make Atletico favorites for the second legs. But if United were to put out their best team, I do think they would have a good chance of winning this tie.
Yeah, I think that could happen too.
Okay, so we've got two people saying Atleti win. Personally, I'm not too sure. I think I want to... Something in my gut says Man United. I don't know if it's just because I want you guys to have more more games until the end of the season, but yeah.
Ronaldo hat-trick incoming.
Mr. Inevitable. So I think that is our... I've never ended a podcast before. I think it's become pretty clear. Okay, cool. Mikey talked me through this part, so please like and subscribe if you liked this video. Please share to your friends. Please
engage with us in the comments and all that.
Engage with us.
Follow
in the comments.
Follow us on all our socials at @football90.
Tell Alex Arsenal won't get top four.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. All right. Cheers.
Have a good one, guys. Bye.